Welcome, everyone, to a post-Thanksgiving episode of the NBA podcast. Hope you all had a great holiday and you're working off those turkey sweats just like I am. Before we get started here, we want to plug a few things. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at the NBA pod. In the bio of that Twitter account, you will find all three of our handles as well, so give us a follow. You can find us on iTunes. We'd love for you to subscribe, to download, leave some reviews. We're always welcome and open to feedback. And we are being hosted this year on FanRag Sports, so be sure to give them a follow on Twitter, at FanRag Sports. And for the NBA channel itself, is at FanRag NBA. With all of that said, as always, I'm joined this week by Morten Jensen and Sarah Chalea. How's it going, guys?
Hey, Brian.
It's good. Lamenting my inability to eat as much as I used to be able to eat.
last year, I had three slices of pie because I was like, I'm going to not take seconds. I've got my eyes on the prize. This year, I only got two, and I'm so disappointed in myself. I feel like I failed Thanksgiving.
I had three pieces of pie as well, and we don't even celebrate Thanksgiving.
That's good to hear, Mort. I think you were celebrating your Bulls doing horrible things to my Sixers. Is that right?
Yeah. You guys really don't look good when Joel Embiid is not playing.
No, I'm just glad you've had your come to Jesus moment and realized that Jahlil Okafor is, in fact, very bad at basketball. It took a while.
Well, I was trying to be optimistic, Brian. Yeah. I mean, look, I'm seeing what everyone else is seeing, but I thought, let me try to get into the corner of this young man and propel his career forwards, and it hasn't happened. So, but here's the thing. I'm still open to the idea of trading for him on the low and then hopefully seeing him explode sometime in the future.
That's fair. Yeah.
I wouldn't mind trading for him if the price is right. Rajon Rondo, for example.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Yeah, I know.
Get that bad juju away right now. So we talked last week about the Pelicans. We were talking about whether Jrue Holiday would help them bounce back after their pretty slow start. Turns out that he did. They won four straight games. They lost to Portland on Friday, but they're looking a lot better. So we just wanted to follow up there and say congrats, Pelicans fans, if you hung tough through the first couple bad weeks of the season, because Anthony Davis, you know, he's had a few injury scares already, but otherwise he looks unstoppable. I think he's had three 40-plus point performances already, and Jrue clearly back. You know, we said he wasn't going to have much rust to shake off, and he does not look rusty at all. So very happy for Pelicans fans. It's always good to have another team in the playoff mix. You know, one team that we were all, I don't want to say super low on in the preseason, but skeptical of, the New York Knicks. And in the first couple weeks of the season, our skepticism was justified, but in their last six games, they are now 5-1, including an overtime win over the Charlotte Hornets on Friday. I wanted to bring up a stat from Josh Eberle of Hoop Mag. You know, this is heading into Friday's game, but through those last five games, Kristaps Porzingis had 75.2 touches per game, which was leading the team, and the Knicks were 4-1. In their first nine, he had 50.3 touches, which was fourth on the team, and the Knicks were 3-6. So, Morten, because half of the Knicks are just former Bulls, do you think these former Bulls / current Knicks are starting to figure it out, or is this just a soft spot in their schedule?
I mean, let's hope they're figuring it out. I can't imagine how someone of anyone, you know, in terms of both player and coach, does not understand until now that you need to put the ball in the hands of your best player, which is so clearly Kristaps Porzingis. With all respect to Melo, Kristaps is the guy the ball needs to go through. And ever since that changed, they've become that much more fluid. I mean, you can even see it in their play. It's just when the ball goes into a guy who's 7'3", who can watch over the defense and shoot from the outside, things open up. Backdoor cuts, movement patterns, you know, back screens. Everything just spreads itself out a little bit more. And, you know, just getting the ball away from Derek is a major positive. I'm not going to say that it couldn't be just a soft spot in the schedule. Mm-hmm. I don't have a lot of confidence in the Knicks. I was being polite there with that word and choosing it very carefully. But here's the thing. Kristaps is the guy who sets their potential. He's the guy who sets the limit as in terms of how far they're going to go. And the fact that they're getting him rolling right now is a huge sign. He's averaging over 20 a game as well now, I think. I think he's... Yeah. So, ride the poor Singa is what I'm saying. Ride the unicorn.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. To your point, he is averaging 20.7 points per game. He has the second most field goal attempts of any Knick. Just behind Carmelo Anthony, he's about one shot ahead of Derrick Rose per game. Shooting nearly 50% from the field, 40% from three-point range, and nearly 80% from the free throw line. Averaging a team-high 2.3 three-pointers per game. So,
yeah.
The unicorn nickname is well-deserved. And I think, you know, as you said, Mort, they need to realize... It can still be, you know, Carmelo Anthony, like, on Friday against the Hornets, blows up for 35 points, 14 rebounds. Like, if he's hot, definitely ride him. Like, he's still an electric scorer and can provide a lot. You know, he had 5 assists, 2 steals, and a block as well against Charlotte. So it's not like he's a bum. We're not saying he's a scrub. But Porzingis is the future of that franchise. So, you know, giving him 50 touches a game over those first 9 games, that's not acceptable. He needs to be one of the primary focal points of the team. And I thought...
Well, Melo is the second guy now, as well he should be. Like, we spoke about this, I think, last year. And I remember, Sarah, you were the one who made the argument. You think you compared it to the Team USA games with Melo, you know, when you saw how well he played, playing off of better players. Mm-hmm. He just seems to have a different vibe to him. Now, I'm not saying Kristaps is necessarily the better player as of right now, but he's the more important player. And it seems like when Carmelo is feeding off of Porzingis, he's playing that much better. So he's essentially becoming the second option. Or am I misremembering what you said?
No, that's I think that's what I said. I had forgotten that I said it until you brought it up.
Excellent start.
But yeah, I mean, we've seen that Carmelo is capable of doing that. I think it was the main point that I was trying to make. But yeah, I mean, it's not like he's this incurable ball hog, but he's, for most of his career, I think, felt the need to take most of the shots, and he hasn't really been wrong most of the time. So I still think they probably isolate with him a little too much. They could find a little better balance. His usage rate is still 29, leading the team. But he can still score. He was fun. When he gets rolling last night, that was really fun. But then at the same time, we all saw the play at the end of regulation where there were at least 2 players open, including Kristaps, and Melo forced up the shot. So they can still work that out a little bit, iron that out. But no, it's certainly important to use both of them at a high rate, but Kristaps needs to get the touches, and it's nice to see him getting them now.
Yeah, it speaks to, I mean, Jeff Hornacek, you know, is a new coach. I'm sure, you know, you need a couple of games to figure out who works best together, get everyone working in your new system. So, you know, we can only hope for Knicks fans that this is a sign of progress and that those early season roadblocks were not, you know, this isn't just an anomaly, this hot streak as of late. Mort, you did crap on Derrick Rose as all Bulls fans are wont to do, but he's actually been playing pretty well as of late. He's got about 18 points, 5 assists, 3 rebounds over his last 5 games, shooting over 45% from the field. And I thought, you know, he spoke the other night about how he recognizes he's never going to be back to his MVP form,
but
he could still hoop, is what he said. So, you know, I think that humility will serve him well. Like, if he tries to take over games and be that all-star scorer and not feed the rest of his teammates, that's going to be trouble for the Knicks. But if he's willing to play that facilitator role while, you know, being a complimentary scorer behind Kristaps and Carmelo, the Knicks, you know, they might actually have something. I think it's, you know, we're 15 games into the season, so it's obviously premature to start declaring anyone a playoff lock aside from a few teams. But they're in the mix now, which I'm surprised by, I would say. So,
well, my intention wasn't to crab on Derek, though. It was more a commentary of how much he's lost.
Yeah, that's fair.
And I mean, look, he's like averaging 16 a game, mm-hmm. more or less.
Yeah.
But doing it on almost 15 shots.
Mm-hmm.
So the efficiency isn't there. He's supposed to be this guy who can get to the line a lot. And to be fair, he does get screwed out of a lot of calls. This has continued in New York and was a trend in Chicago. I don't know what it is, but he does not get the calls that he should be getting, and that's obviously to his disadvantage.
Right.
But it just seems like he still wants to be that guy. He still, when the ball is in his hands and he sees just a slither of an open lane, he tries to take advantage of it. And I can sort of respect the attempt, but as soon as the first dribble has been taken, he loses his mind and just forgets the options around him. It just happens so frequently. The guy I really should be crabbing all over is really Mr. 31.6% from the free throw line, Joakim Noah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's not looked as advertised from a guy earning $72
million. Yeah. It's, we question the wisdom, not necessarily of the price tag, but of the length of that deal. And nothing that we've seen in the first month of the season has calmed nerves there. So. Knicks fans have plenty of reason to be optimistic. There is still, maybe Joakim gets going in a little bit, and they have even more reasons to be optimistic. But we're just happy to see the Knicks back in playoff contention because, they've been a tire fire for a couple of years now. So it's nice to see them back on their feet. One team that we were all pretty high on heading into the year were the Detroit Pistons. We knew that Reggie Jackson was going to miss about a month. Due to a platelet-rich plasma injection in his knee during the preseason. And a right thumb injury as well. But he should be back soon. In his absence, the Pistons have not really... They haven't taken off like expected. They're 8-9 right now. They did just beat the Clippers on Friday night in a pretty surprising victory there. But they're the eighth seed. They're tied with Indiana. Again, it's early. They're only 2.5 games back from the number two seed. So they're not out of the running by any means. But, Sarah, you had experience watching Mr. Reggie Jackson while he was a member of the Oklahoma City Thunder. Do you think he's going to turn this team into a legitimate threat to Cleveland, and along with like Toronto, Atlanta, those teams?
It's tough to say without saying that obviously, the Cavs are far and away the favorite. I think that Detroit can be a valid threat. What was really nice about their big win last night that you mentioned against the Clippers, they're playing with a really great balance right now. Like Ish Smith is running the team really well. I think they may have out-lobbed Lob City last night. Drummond was flying all over the place. And then they have perimeter threats. Tobias Harris is playing really well. KCP. It's nice. I think they had all their starters were in double figures last night. Did you have Darren Hilliard, who I've been waiting for him to crack? I'm a Villanova fan, so I've been waiting for him to crack the rotation. He had 19 minutes, 9 points last night. So the only slight fear is when you get somebody back who's really talented and actually your primary ball handler, a little worried that that might disrupt the balance for a little bit. I think they need to try to maintain that, but hopefully they'll come out of it for the better, and Reggie will find his way in that balance.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ishmith hopefully can be great off the bench for him. And then defensively, they're, third in opponents' points per game, sixth in defensive rating. So that's great. I mean, I definitely think that they could be a challenger in the East, and I think they're going to move up. And Stan's still not even playing Boban, so I have to shout out Boban always.
He's just waiting to unleash Boban until the playoffs. Yeah. It's an 82-game slow roll from Stan Van Gundy. I'm writing a piece about this on B-Ball Breakdown, so keep an eye out for that in a couple days about a longer version of these thoughts. But, you know, short version is it's very similar to Drew Holiday. When you're getting back your starting point guard, it's not going to hurt over the long run. I mean, I think your concern about disrupting chemistry is completely valid. And I think, you know, the Pelicans have been smart bringing Drew off the bench for these first couple games, even though he wasn't coming off an injury. I think I would be surprised if the Pistons didn't do the same thing, at least at first, because Ish has been playing well. You know, he's shooting under 40% from the field, but so it goes with Ish Smith. But aside from that, he's distributing the ball very well. You know, Harris, as you mentioned, is just balling. And Morton, this is when you and I cackle, as usual, about Orlando giving him up for salary dump.
I'm just shaking my head instead this time. Trying to shake things up instead of cackling.
So I mean, Sarah, you said it well. The Cavs are still far and away the class of the East. But you know, I think Detroit. I would be very surprised if Detroit's not in that mix with Toronto, Atlanta, Boston, even Chicago. You know, jostling for that 2, 3, 4 seed come playoff time, because you know they've got the depth. Like, we didn't even mention John Lewis. He's playing out of his mind, which I don't think, you know, he kind of flew under the radar this summer as a free agent signing. So Stan Van Gundy, he's proving to be one of the rare examples or exceptions. You know, usually the coach / GM role ends poorly, but he's actually so far doing pretty well.
And, I mean, when you look at the team right now, was it maybe a bit lucky that they got this start without Reggie in a way to you know, you get more guys who get more shots. You have, let me see, 4 guys averaging 12 shots a game. Mm-hmm. That's going to go away when Reggie returns. But I like getting those guys into a flow, and they have had 17 games to discover this. So when Reggie comes back, obviously you'll need a time of adjustment, but those guys have now gotten a lot of shots under their skin. They've gotten a lot of minutes. Now they might be more inclined to hit at a better rate. You don't know. It doesn't hurt, is my point, really. What I am nervous about, though, is who is their main guy? I know it's Drummond on paper, and I know offensively it's probably going to be Reggie, but is that enough? It seems like this team just lacks that one star. It seems this team, it has the components for a championship squad. They have the second guy. Mm-hmm. They have the supporting cast. Now they need the superstar. I feel they continuously are one piece away from really challenging Cleveland and the San Antonio Spurs and Golden State. They just need that one guy. One guy. And I wonder if there's even a move to be made. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have Stanley Johnson waiting in the wings. He could take over the small forward position. Now, was he just suspended for a personal matter?
Violation of team rules was how it was phrased. So we don't know.
Oh, okay. So we don't know what that was. Not necessarily something big. No. But like, where do you guys stand on this? How is Detroit going to take that next leap? Because we talk about them as this challenger or potential challenger to the Cavs, but we need one more guy there.
Yeah, it's a fair point. You know, they are just loaded with young guys, like KCP's 23, Harris is 24, Drummond's 23, Stanley Johnson's 20. So they have room for internal growth, but you know, speaking for this year, I don't know on paper that there's a move unless you're nervous about KCP's extension but restricted free agency, and maybe you move him. I don't know that you're going to get that much for him since he is going to be a free agent this summer. But you know, maybe someone wants to take a gamble and you upgrade and get a veteran. I don't know that you necessarily want to do that. I feel like you've got a pretty solid core as is. Maybe you just hope for internal growth, and if a trade comes up a trade opportunity arises, get yourself in that mix. You have plenty of attractive assets, mostly in terms of players. So, I don't know if there's an easy answer this year, but in the long run, I think the big hope is something like the Tobias Harris deal, where you have you take advantage of a team's desperation and unload bad contracts on a guy who, for whatever reason, has fallen out of favor in his current location. Because, you know, already that deal is playing huge dividends in Detroit.
I was kind of hoping that Harris would, you know, become that player.
Yeah, I think that is, yeah, again, he's only 24, so it's...
He might, yeah. You never know. He looks really good, but yeah, I mean, there's still another step to be taken. They could be the 04 Pistons and not need a guy. I mean, not to put them on that level yet, and those teams are really rare, but it does happen, especially if you have a good defense, and, you know, it's not like they don't have guys who can create, and they have a coach who can... you know, help manufacture points without needing to ISO a superstar as much. But I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, that's a good point. 04 Pistons would be a good model, at least for this year. And then we see what happens in free agency and whatnot. But they definitely
KCP
have...
KCP for Noel.
I would do that. At this point, Nerlens is gone. He's like, I'm worried that he's going to do the Greg Monroe thing and take a qualifying offer and play it out and become an unrestricted free agent. It sounds like he is completely checked out on the Sixers, so what I would have called an asking price for him 3 months ago is completely different than what I expect now. Like, I think Brandon Knight, as horrible as he has been this year, I think he is too much for Nerlens at this point. So, I think the Sixers would have to package a pick with Nerlens for KCP. And I don't even know, you know, why Detroit's got Drummond. Why Nerlens wants to play the five. You need to find a team.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I keep forgetting that he doesn't want to play the four. I was just thinking, because there are several ways you can win a championship. You can have that one superstar, or you can get a group of nasty-ass bigs who just protect the paint and make sure that everyone is forced to take at least a 15-foot contested jump shot, right?
Yeah.
And Noel and Drummond would definitely make sure that you... are going to think twice before you enter the paint.
Yeah, that's true.
And you could stagger them to make them, you know, the primary shot blocker or whatever. I would just love that flexibility, but you're right. I keep forgetting that Noel is very stubborn in wanting to play the five.
Yeah, this 220-pound guy thinks he's going to hold up at the five all season. So
damn it, Nerlens.
Yeah. Well, we'll hopefully find a more feasible trade target for Detroit in the coming weeks, or we'll just hope for them to, you know, once Reggie comes back, we'll see how they get rolling. But I think you have a good point in that his early season absence might end up being a blessing in disguise, because they realize they can play basically 500 ball without him. So, you know, that's a good sign. The Pelicans sure as hell couldn't do that without Drew. So speaks to, again, what Van Gundy has built there. He really has a well-rounded complementary roster. You know, one team that we're not surprised by, Milwaukee. You know, they are off to a pretty mediocre 6-8 start. I mean, the Chris Middleton injury basically set them back this year. They were, you know, they looked like a possible playoff contender until he got hurt. And now it's like, all right, let's just see how the Greek Freak is doing as point guard. I want to bring up one stat that I saw on Twitter last night from @TPCourier. Matt Moore of CBS Sports retweeted this last night, and I saw it in my timeline. I was like, oh my god, this might not be great for Milwaukee. So, entering Friday night, with Jabari off the court, Giannis had an offensive rating of 123.8, which would annihilate anything any other team is doing. And then a 105 defensive rating in 137 minutes. With Parker on the court, he has a 100.5 offensive rating and a 104.6 defensive rating in 318 minutes. So the defensive rating is about the same either way. Offensive rating goes up by more than 23 points per 100 possessions with Jabari off the court. So Morton... yeah, I sent you that stat earlier, and your reaction was just, oh my god. Do you think these two can coexist long-term, given those stats?
Well, during the Milwaukee games I've seen, I've noticed that they do tend to attack from the same angles, but not to the extent that I thought, oh, okay, there's this significant difference between the numbers when Giannis, or sorry, when Jabari's on or off. So that was actually pretty surprising. I think I want Jabari to take more corner threes. It seems like he can hit it. He's shooting 43% from the corners. So if he adopts more of a three-point nature to his game, and then when Giannis is out and he's in, then he can attack the rim and maybe get some interior buckets, then that would probably be the setup. But it's a difficult question, man. I have no idea. They're so young, so I don't feel that they've been shaped yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have an idea of the type of players they're going to become, but I don't think that process is remotely close to being done. And this is, 13-14 game sample?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so it could get better, but it's still significant, and it does show a slight concern there. But yeah, I would definitely put Jabari in the corner, and then I would hope that Giannis improves the long ball as well, because that would just open up everything.
Yeah.
Maybe that's really the answer. Just as long as they get better from deep, that might actually fix the problem in itself.
Yeah.
Or am I just being way too optimistic there?
No, I think it's Giannis is shooting 16% from three-point range on 2.2 attempts per game this year. So that's not great. Obviously, at this point, it's basically the last step in his development, because he's otherwise putting up unheard of numbers, like 22 points, 8 rebounds, 6 assists, 2 blocks, and nearly 2 steals per game. So he's really handling this point Giannis thing with aplomb, and he's still putting up huge defensive numbers too, which is, he's kid's 22 years old, he's a 7-footer, and he glides like a point guard. Like, it's He, like Porzingis, deserves this unicorn label, as there is no one else in the NBA who could do what Giannis does. So I think, if you're going to be forced to choose between the two at some point, the choice is very simple. And I think, at this point, Jabari Parker's averaging almost 20 points a game. So you could get a lot for him on the trade market, I would assume. He's still got a year and a half left on his rookie deal. The ultimate concern is that, in theory, they're both best suited to play the four. So how you navigate that, whether you put Giannis at three, I don't think Jabari has the foot speed, to the lateral foot speed especially, to guard opposing wings. Like, put him against Paul George and you're asking for Paul George to hang up 40 on you, or Jimmy Butler, as Mort can attest. So I think you have to put Giannis there defensively at least, and then Parker also, he's got that low post game, so I think you want to put him there offensively as well. That matters less. It's more of the defensive issues. So, Mort, I think you're right that it's too early to completely, jump ship on this. Like, if you look at Milwaukee, the rest of Milwaukee, without Chris Middleton, Tony Snell is their third leading scorer right now. Tony Snell should never be any team's third leading scorer. Like, with that in mind, it's a miracle that they are 6-8 instead of like 2-10.
Can I just add a note?
Yes.
He has played 378 minutes and he's taking 4 three throws. when you look down the roster of the Bucks, they are horrendous at getting to the line.
Yeah.
You have Snell with he's averaging 0.3 attempts per game. You have Dellavedova with less than one. You have Malcolm Brogdon, who plays over 20 minutes, only gets the line 1.4 times. Jason Terry, just 0.6. Then you have Greg Monroe coming off the bench, who does it decently, but then back down again. John Henson, 1.3. Teletovic, 0.7. Rashad Vaughn in 9 games, I don't even think he's been to the line. He hasn't been to the line. I mean, so there are definitely major concerns there, because you're not squeezing out the extra points. And as you alluded to, Tony Snell, when he's your third leading scorer, you are in desperate need of an injection of offense.
Yeah.
So my question comes back to you. Actually, I'm going to redirect that to Sarah, because we're talking about a big man here, Greg Monroe. Should Greg actually play a larger part of the Bucks offense, even though he's not this new era guy?
I don't think that's a bad idea. Like you said, they're really hurting. They're like 19th in offensive rating. Mm-hmm. It's not really going to get it done. So,
and bad on the glass too.
Yeah, yeah. So why not? I mean, you might as well shake it up. You don't have Middleton this year, like we said. It's kind of a lost year, but you know, there's no reason that you can't develop and try to see if you find something else that works. Because even with Middleton back, you have to imagine that they still would be struggling offensively. Mm. So yeah, I mean, that's worth a shot. I know, Brian, you posed the question, do they have any long-term keepers on the roster outside of Giannis? As Morton said, I think it's too soon to say. You kind of want to see how this season shakes out, and if anybody distinguishes themselves. But yeah, I would say nobody has cemented themselves as untouchable so far. Ideally, with Giannis, who's going to live in the paint and just wreak havoc, you would want to surround him with shooters. But you know, they don't have a lot of that right now. They've got Jason Terry is, you know, a million years old. So yeah, and then Teletovic. So hang on to Teletovic maybe. But yeah, it looks pretty rough on that roster. Steve Novak can't get on the floor. Is he hurt or is he just not playing?
I haven't heard of an injury, so I'm gonna assume just not playing. It seems like I mean, Jason Kidd, I'm wondering how much leash he has given how he's kind of jerked around minutes, especially at center. You know, that like Henson and Miles Plumlee have been splitting starts. Monroe in 13 games has not started a single time, paying him close to $20 million a year. I mean, Mort, as you said, he's that low post guy, so he's not necessarily, we've talked about this in past podcasts, how those guys now seem to be best on that second unit, like Zebo, like Al Jefferson, like Okafor, you know, back to the basket bigs can just abuse backup big men. So in theory, that's where, I guess that's Kidd's logic, but it does strike me. I mean, he's, you know, he's not, Monroe has never been a great defensive player. He dating back to his days at Georgetown, he can't really guard a pick and roll very well at all. I mean, he's one step above Jahlil Okafor in that regard. So, Milwaukee wants to build itself as this defensive team. So, I guess in that regard, that's probably the rationale behind not starting him and starting guys like Plumlee and Henson. You know, I think ultimately you're hoping Thon Maker turns out to be the long-term answer at center. And then you find a point guard in the draft or in free agency, you shift Deli to the bench. And then, you know, with Thon, with Parker, with Giannis, with Chris Middleton, that has the potential to be something. But yeah, I think we said it well here that this is kind of a lost season for Milwaukee. So,
And you don't want Monroe to get in Giannis's way is the only problem.
True. So yeah.
It's a tough call.
Yeah. But
I will say I like having a guy like Dellavedova so you can run Giannis as a role man. Mm-hmm. That's pretty fun. But that's about the only thing I could say right now that they've found this year that I really like.
Yeah.
Besides point guard Giannis. So,
yeah. Right. At least we have that, so you're not a total lost cause Milwaukee.
Can we please cement Deli as Derek Fisher 2.0?
I think our boy James Hollis has been leading that crusade for months.
Yeah, to be fair, I actually mentioned it before James. He got it from us. So, yeah, no, but I just, you know, hey, here's the thing. He's a guy who allows wing players to dribble up the court, shoot a lot, and then he just spots up nice and easy. Mm-hmm. And then he's feisty as hell.
Yeah.
My God, they really needed that signing.
Yeah.
As well as Teletovic. I mean, those are two hard-nosed guys. I feel sorry for him in sense of having that lost year because I believe Teletovic is 30?
Yeah, I think he's up 30. There.
Yeah. And Deli is 26, 27, so he's not a spring chicken either. Mm-hmm. So we got to hope the Bucks bounce back next year and because they're on long-term deals. And Middleton coming back is going to help
big time. For sure. And he's still on one of the best deals in the NBA. You know, he signed pre-cap explosion. So long-term, I think the Bucks are going to be just fine. This year, not so much.
No,
but
no.
It's okay. You still got Greek Freak. Milwaukee fans. Sarah, I'm going to ask you about this next team because your Spurs just beat them on Friday. The Boston Celtics, you know, they were hit hard by injuries early in the season. Al Horford had a concussion that kept him out for a couple weeks. Jay Crowder sprained an ankle, I believe. Marcus Smart missed a few games at the beginning of the year. They're 9-7, so they're fifth place in the East. They are only one game out of second. So, again, super early, not burying anyone. That said, I think most of us expected them to be closer to 11-5, 10-6, like probably the top threat to Cleveland, maybe next to Toronto if you were higher on them. But I think it's safe to say that this breakout season for Boston has not quite come to fruition just yet. Sarah, did you see anything in that Spurs game yesterday that caught your eye in terms of what they're still missing?
Well, you guys know I'm biased, but I do feel like perhaps they're missing like that one other big.
Mm-hmm.
I know the league has gotten away from that, but I always feel like, you know, you could use, it's kind of like Golden State when they got David Lee, I thought was huge for them, but they were still missing something.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, Bogut. So, yeah, I feel like Horford was huge, but they could still use something else. I will say that I've put most of their difficulty so far on the fact that you've only had Horford for 7 games and Jay Crowder for 8 games. Their defense is probably not as good as it could be, and partially because of that, especially missing Crowder. Like yesterday, the matchups were too good to be true. You know, you had Crowder and Kawhi, Danny Green and Avery Bradley. And it was just that it was basketball porn. But their defense I think should improve, but it wasn't great yesterday. It was competitive, but it wasn't great because they had the Spurs down. Spurs have sucked at afternoon games forever. They just don't get up well. So they were down huge. I think it was at least 14, if not up 17. And they crawled their way back in it because, you know, I don't know if Boston knew who Davis Bertans was. So that bit them. And then they should have known who Patty Mills is. But, yeah. So they could pick that up, their three-point defense. I haven't looked at. Let's see. What is their defensive rating for 3 points? Yeah, not great. They giving up, they're 19th in the league as far as giving up 3-point attempts, although they're 11th in percentage, so that's not terrible. But yeah, I think they'll get better. I don't know that they're the clear number two that we thought they were going to be coming into the league, though.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the one thing I will say. But yeah, for the most part, I think they're fine. They just needed to get healthy.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, you know, they were a bottom five defense for a good chunk of the season, like 4 weeks or so, but a good chunk of the season. They're 19th now, so they are moving back up a little bit now that Jay and Horford are back. The one thing that's, I don't know, that's fixable, at least without a trade, you know, you mentioned their need for another big. They are 30th in defensive rebound percentage. They are dead last, and I don't think that's a coincidence because when Horford was in Atlanta, they were also toward the bottom of the league in rebound percentage. You know, Horford's averaging 6.9 boards per game. Avery Bradley, who is almost a foot shorter than him, is averaging 8.0. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's just not that board-gobbling center. He's not a DeAndre Jordan. He's not an Andre Drummond. He's not a Dwight Howard. Whether that is going to prohibit them from beating a team like Cleveland that has two guys like Kevin Love and Tristan Thompson remains to be seen. That said, it is a big concern because your other big, who's starting all 16 games, Amir Johnson, is averaging 4.3 boards per game. So they've got a good spread of rebounding, but they don't have that one guy who is going to swallow up rebounds. So again, you know, it goes back to what we've been saying for a while. They've been sitting on a bunch of assets. They haven't cashed them in. You know, that Nets pick is now depreciating.
Yeah.
So it just, this team feels like, much like Detroit, they feel like they're still one piece away. I mean, Isaiah Thomas is playing out of his freaking mind. He's averaging 26 a game. He's, you know, he's looking like, if he's not going to make the All-Star team, he's going to be pretty close to it. But you know, maybe it's just a matter of getting healthy, but it does feel like, as you said, Sarah, this is not number two with a bullet. They definitely have competition, if nothing else. All right, so let's go to the Timberwolves. Morton, I want to go to you for this one. I'm not going to gloat because, again, it's early. We need to just preface all of this analysis with it's early and no one is completely buried aside from maybe the Dallas Mavericks. But the T-Wolves are 5-10. They beat the Suns on Friday, but they got absolutely annihilated by New Orleans on Wednesday. They, unlike the Celtics, have not really had many injury problems. You know, Ricky Rubio was out a little while with a sprained elbow, but Chris Dunn played well in his stead. Wiggins and Towns are both healthy, playing well. Zach LaVine's playing well. What's going on with Thibodeau and the T-Wolves, Mort?
Well, their offense isn't too great, and they do have some issues defensively in simply allowing too many open shots, because they are allowing an effective field goal percentage of 51.4, which is 24th in the league, and very un-Tipsian, I should add. But yeah, I mean, they just can't get their offense together. They're attempting only 23 three-pointers a night, which, I mean, you really can't do that when you have Zach LaVine and you have Karl Anthony Towns and Pleyanka and Shabazz. You have a lot of guys, Brandon Rush as well. You have the personnel to launch more threes and don't. And even, hell, even Andrew Wiggins is hitting the long ball at 41%. So the guys are there. It's just not being taken a lot. And they need a rebounder. They simply need a rebounder. They are 27th in the league in rebounding. Very, again, un-Tipsian, and I'm surprised at what is happening, honestly. Maybe they're too young? Mm-hmm. That's an initial speculation. I saw a fake rumor from Rick Butcher about him. I assume it's a fake rumor because it's from Rick. That Tibbs was considering sending one of the primary youngsters away from a veteran. So, you know, like one of Wiggins, LaVine, and Towns, and that's utterly ridiculous. It would have to be LaVine out of those three, and even that is ridiculous, especially coming in like 15 games into the year.
Yeah.
But I do feel that certain moves they made in the summer is going to be problematic. Like Cole Aldrich getting the deal that he did. I'm looking back at it. It was fine. It's fitting for his caliber, but I would rather have the cap space for next summer to help upgrade.
Yeah, that's fair.
They need another guy. I mean,
if they want to do LaVine for Nerlens, I can give them Brian Colangelo's phone number because I'm certainly down for that. I mean, I think to your point about the rebounding, you know, Towns is averaging more than 9 a game. Gorgui Dieng's averaging almost 9 a game. No one else is averaging more than 5 a game. And that has long been the one thing with Wiggins. You know, he's not a great passer, and he's not a great rebounder. He's a great scorer, an elite scorer already, but he has not rounded out his game quite yet. And I think that was our hope with Thibodeau. You know, would he do that, what he did to Jimmy Butler, would he do that with Andrew Wiggins? So far, Wiggins is scoring better than he ever has, but we still have yet to see him make progress in those other areas. Especially, you know, he's averaging 0.4 steals, 0.5 blocks. Like, the kid should be a menace on defense. And, you know, again, he's only 21. Like, it's still way too early to write this guy off as any, you know, just a scorer. And even if he is just a scorer, look at Carmelo Anthony. He made a hell of a career out of a very similar profile. You know, I think there is reason for optimism in Minnesota. I think this team will get better as the season goes on. The question becomes, you know, I think it was Adrian Wojnarowski who had that story about Rubio, and he said, like, the Wolves, it was before the season started, and he said the Wolves were rebuffing any Rubio trade discussions at the beginning of the year. They were waiting. They said, like, it's going to be about 20 games before Chris Dunn takes over as the starting point guard. Both guys are shooting under 35% from three. From the field, sorry, which is horrible. You know, Rubio has never been super efficient as a scorer, but you need close to 40%. You know, he's not averaging that many shots per game, but you need to have some sort of, he can't just be Rajon Rondo, basically. He needs to be some scoring presence, at least some threat, or defenses are just going to collapse on Wiggins, Levine, and Towns. So I think there is a reason for hope still in Minnesota long term. This core has some of the best upside in the league. But I think, you know, the T-Wolves are a trendy playoff pick before the season started. As of now, it's looking like we might have crowned them a year too early. So, you know, I think they might wind up in that, like, 10th or 11th spot in the West, especially with the Lakers playing as unexpectedly well as they are.
Oh, that could get scary, because if they get a high pick, I mean, damn.
Yeah, and this draft, too. I mean, you know, it's always, we always go through these cycles with every NBA draft class where in the winter, or in, like, the fall leading into winter, it's, oh my god, this class is so deep, it's going to be full of all-stars. And then in February, everyone's like, well, actually, there's maybe one or two guys who are kind of good. And then come May and June again, it's like, oh yeah, no, it's really good, all-time great class, full of superstars. So right now we're in that, you know, the 2017 class looked great, and a lot of the top-tier guys especially have played very, very well. Especially, you know, Josh Jackson, Markelle Fultz, Lonzo Ball. So yeah, add, you know, it's the same thing with
Markelle Fultz.
Yeah, it's the same thing with Philly. You know, like, add one or two of those guys to Philly, add one or two of those guys to Minnesota. Now you're rolling. So Minnesota fans, there's.
But let me ask you guys the thing. Let me ask you guys the thing though.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to make a change with Minnesota right now in terms of trade, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you had to say, okay, no Wiggins, no Levine, no Towns.
Mm-hmm.
What would you do? Like, what kind of player would you look to ship? Like, as Shabazz Muhammad, who has potential and is durable?
No, I feel like...
What kind of guy would you move
Rubio. I think you'd find it...
Well, what kind of value does he have?
He's on a pretty cheap deal, right?
Yeah, but he sucks right now. Like, horrifically.
I think... You know, the sprained elbow, maybe he's still working his way. He's not 100% yet. So you probably, if you're going to move him today, his value is lower than it would have been at the start of the season, presumably. And, you know, the fact he's still, he just is not a great three-point shooter. Teams are going to play with him like they did Rondo. That said, I think, you know, a team like Dallas that is perpetually dealing with Deron Williams, who's, you know, just gets banged up every other game, it feels like, and J.J. Barea is out for 6 weeks now. The Sixers, you know, they, especially, Jared Bayless is playing well since he's come back. Sergio has been playing up and down, and Simmons is coming back, but maybe Brian Colangelo has a panic trade and moves New Orleans for Rubio. I think there are offers out there, but
yeah,
I think what you need, you know, at this point, you need to stay competitive enough that guys don't check out. But I don't think it's the end of the world if you miss the playoffs this year, especially given how young all of the main guys are.
Yeah, there are some questions, though. When you look at it, like, Shabazz is actually a restricted free agent at the end of the season, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you got to, like, make a decision on him. You're paying Gorgui Dieng this upcoming summer as well, so you're taking a small hit free agency wise, and so you're kind of limited to hitting home in either a trade or the draft. But right now it just seems like they need a point guard. They really need a guy who can control the show, and Chris Dunn doesn't even look remotely ready, and I'm really disappointed in Dunn, honestly. I thought he would have been a hell of a lot better, even though it's only 15 games into the season. He was the most, at least he was the projected as the most NBA-ready guy in the whole draft.
Right.
I mean, and he looked so explosive. He is explosive. And, what, 3.8 points a game, 32% from the field. He's looked insecure. He's been actually been a decent defender, but offensively speaking, it looks like he's really having trouble managing the team.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm really not sure what's going on there.
Especially, you know, he looked so good in Summer League and all of that stuff about his NBA readiness. It's like, oh, yeah, there he is. He's totally ready to run a team. And, you know, when I read that thing from Woj at the beginning of the season, it was like, holy crap, they expect him to take over after 20 games? Like, Rubio's usually pretty good. So it seems like they were hoping for him to be a little bit more ready than he is. But, again, it's still early, and maybe it's like this, they have a Jeff Teague, Dennis Schroeder kind of dynamic going on, where neither guy can really get comfortable and thrive because he's splitting time with the other. So maybe they just need to make a move for the sake of making a move and hope Chris Dunn doesn't, you know, sink or swim with Chris Dunn and hope he doesn't sink.
Dennis Schroeder, he would be good there, though.
Yeah, he'd be fun.
No, you just mentioned that. I just put him in a T-Wolves jersey.
Something tells me Atlanta's not going to go for that.
Yeah, no, definitely.
I want to also give out, we could talk about them more on our next episode, but a brief shout out to the Memphis Grizzlies. They are fourth in the West right now, despite Chandler Parsons being out for a good portion of the year, either resting or limited, or now he's out again with a bone bruise in his knee. They're 10-6, tied with the Houston Rockets for fourth, only three games back of the San Antonio Spurs. You know, Marc Gasol is shooting threes, and that's an actual thing. The Sixers played them in double overtime the other night, and I was watching that game, and he was like just raining threes on us. I'm like, oh, great, okay. Who's that guy who's actually shooting threes? It's not Tony Allen. Oh, it's a 7-footer. Cool. Okay, so he's playing well. Mike Conley is thriving under David Fizdale. So again, we will talk more about the Grizzlies our next episode, but just wanted to shout them out because we haven't really mentioned them all that much this year so far. We're now going to turn to our Where Amazing Happens segment, and we've had some amazing stuff happen this past week, haven't we? I think, you know, the two big ones, Kevin Love had 34 points in the first quarter against Portland on Wednesday. It's the second most points ever in a quarter, the most points ever in a first quarter. Also somewhat speaks to what a tire fire Portland has become. I think we talked about this a few weeks ago. We briefly touched on this. But, Mort, do you think Kevin Love is starting to really fit in there, huh?
Just took him 2.5 years. Yeah. No. I mean, look, kidding aside, he looks to be the former Kevin Love again.
Yeah.
And we've been waiting on this, and no one could really figure out why he couldn't like return to the former glory that was himself, because he was still a shooter in Minnesota. He was still a guy who could gobble up rebounds, and suddenly he was just standing out there and not getting the kickouts, and he was not entering the paint a whole lot, like limiting himself to eight or nine boards a game. Like, now it seems like it's become a priority for the whole organization to get him going.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of like, you know, we gave you a contract worth, what, $110 million. LeBron is getting older. We have Kyrie who can spot up from the outside and take care of business from outside the arc. Now it's your turn. You know, go inside, do the dirty work, come back out when you have a pick and pop option. You know, be the guy that we traded for.
Mm-hmm.
And he is. And that first quarter was just, it was sort of a coming out party in a weird sense, right? Sort of like, hey, league, take notice. I'm actually back.
Yeah.
And that was wonderful to see. He was actually enjoying himself. And this sounds ridiculous, but have you guys noticed how much he smiles this year compared to the last 2 years?
Yeah. No, I mean,
seems like he's actually happy now. Yeah.
There's something to that.
Yeah. So it's definitely interesting, and the Cavs getting better is frightening for everyone.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah, I mean, to your point about just him being back to the old Kevin Love, he's averaging 22 points and nearly 11 rebounds a game in 32 minutes, like in somewhat limited playing time. I mean, I'm getting a very 2012-13 Miami Heat vibe from the Cavs this year. Like, remember, Chris Bosh had these same struggles for the first 2 years next to Wade and LeBron, and then they win that first championship, and it just clicks. And all of a sudden, it's not like, you know, remember, like, there was the Like a Bosh skit?
Yeah.
Where it's just like, you're the third wheel, and every time something goes wrong, we're going to blame you. That's kind of what Kevin Love was these first 2 years in Cleveland. But now that he has the validation of a title, and especially he was the guy who guarded Curry on that, you know, attempted game-tying three-pointer in Game 7 in the series in which the Warriors blew a 3-1 lead for the first time in NBA history in the finals. It's
oh, man.
It had been a while.
Yeah, I was waiting for it. Yeah, yeah. Just because Donald Trump's our president doesn't mean I forgot about that. Yeah, I mean, it just seems like his confidence is back. So it really feels like he's okay with, if he has to take a back seat to LeBron and Kyrie at times, that's fine. But more to your point, it does seem like LeBron is really making an effort to get Love going. Like, a lot of those three-pointers against Portland in that first quarter were off of LeBron drives to the basket, goes under the hoop, kicks cross-court to Love, who's wide open for a three, which, again, somewhat speaks to Portland and whatever they're doing on defense. But it's terrifying to see Kevin Love fully actualized on this team, because, you know, again, everyone was crowning the Warriors before the season starts. The Cavs are looking like they are not going to go down easy if they do have their rubber match in the finals. But we do also have to talk about the Warriors, because they dropped 149 points on the Los Angeles Lakers on Wednesday.
Oh, but before we do, you mentioned Portland.
Uh-huh.
And remember, I shot you both a direct message on Twitter
last week? Yeah.
Right. So is there a better big man to fix the defensive issues in Portland than Serge Ibaka? And wouldn't an Ibaka for Alan Crabtree make a whole lot of sense for both sides? When you really think about for Orlando, let's start there. Mm-hmm. They can finally move Aaron Gordon up to the four.
Yep.
And they would get an established young guy who can shoot. And Portland would get that pick-and-pop big who can also block shots and run the floor. Come on now.
Yeah.
Say it with me now. Crap for Ibaka.
I, you know, it makes sense, but I don't know if you're Rob Hennigan, can you say you basically traded Oladipo and Sabonis? It would wind up being for Crab because they traded those guys for Ibaka. And then, you know, I think that the opportunity cost is going to be what holds that up. But otherwise, yeah, you know, you slide Fournier back to the three. You have another shooter in the starting lineup next to Elfrid Payton. So it makes sense, especially because Orlando, the biggest issue right now is Aaron Gordon is out of position. And until that gets fixed, it's just bad news bears. So if you can get a guy who is productive like Crab and who has shown flashes, it would be interesting.
No, but I agree. I agree. But here's the thing. I hate the fact that a GM can sort of hide behind the fact, oh, I don't want to do that because that proves that I was wrong.
Right.
Well, you were wrong
right.
from the first time around. I mean, come on. You made a badass trade and now you can actually help your team get along. I mean, you can help them along by getting a younger guy, and you can give the superior option at the 4 minutes of that position. I mean, yeah, you messed up, but at least fix it. I would prefer that over a GM who just stubbornly sits on his decisions.
Yeah, that's the problem. In sports, it's just so easy to watch mistakes compound, and there is that stubbornness with, like, well, I made this trade, so I can't admit I lost already and sell 40 cents on the dollar and, you know, basically say I screwed up in acquiring Ibaka. So I think maybe the best hope for Orlando in that sense is to get rid of Hennigan midseason, have someone take over, say Samuel Hinkie, and then and then have him flip Ibaka at the deadline, because otherwise you don't want to re-sign Ibaka if you're Orlando, or else you're just perpetuating this problem with Aaron Gordon. So at that point, you'd almost have to trade Aaron Gordon.
Still, Ibaka with the Blazers, though?
Yeah, that would fix a lot. I mean, it would not fix the Evan Turner problem. So fun. But,
yeah.
You know, it might even free him up a little bit more on the bench, so he's got more free reign once Dame and CJ are off the court. But we do need to briefly mention the Warriors.
Yeah.
You know, 149 points. Sarah, is it time to worry about their world domination tour?
No, I'm not going to worry. I refuse to worry.
Spoken like Spurs fan.
That's right. No, I saw it go across the timeline, I think, that night. Plus, what did they have, like 47 assists the other night? That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like, I can't even imagine that. And it was like on 50 field goals or something. But anyway, somebody poses a question, like, what's more likely at this point? Them scoring 90 plus and a half or winning a championship? And it really might be 90 plus and a half.
Yeah.
There's at least some challengers for the championship. And I would say, I mean, you mentioned the Cavs. I don't know why, but we didn't really pick who we thought was going to be the champion when we did our season preview. Or unless we just all assumed it was the Warriors, so we didn't feel like we had to pick. I don't know.
I did, so admittedly.
There you go. Yeah. But no, I was thinking that I was going to pick the Cavs simply because I just didn't want it to be that predictable. So you know, I thought maybe something might happen with the Warriors. They had all the drama coming out with the article about Draymond being kind of Draymond. What else can you say?
Yeah.
So I was like, well, maybe he goes crazy and something happens. But I don't know. Yeah, there's at least challengers for that. So I could really see them putting up 90 and a half.
Yeah, they were they had like 81 against the Lakers, right? They were not far off from doing that already. And I think the hope, at least early in the season, was Klay Thompson really seemed to be in a funk and he just couldn't hit threes for the life of him. That's gone. He's still only shooting 35% from three, but he's hitting team high 2.7. Or no, sorry, Curry's hitting more, but the second most.
More.
Sorry, just kidding. Stephen Curry is still Stephen Curry. But the second most three-pointers on the team at 2.7 per game. And, you know, Durant, he's basically putting up his OKC numbers in Golden State. Like, you know, Klay had that whole crap about he's not going to have to sacrifice, and it turns out he is, unless they keep scoring 149 points a night, in which case they're going to sit out for like the entire fourth quarter and some of the third. But you know, their depth, we did talk about that being a concern, and so far, like, outside of Durant, Curry, Thompson, and Draymond, you know, Iggy has not looked like vintage Iggy.
No.
I think Zach Lowe had covered that in one of his recent columns about how that's, you know, that could be a huge weakness if that super depth lineup, if Iggy's not locking down the opposing weapon as well, or if he's not hitting threes, he's shooting 27.5% from deep this year. Suddenly, the Warriors don't look so invincible. So, and, you know, I as a Sixers fan who has no dog in this fight in terms of the championship, I think it is time to worry about the Warriors. They're 14-2. They're, you know, they look as good as we expected. That said, there are holes that we also thought might be present. So if you are a fan of the Cavs or the Spurs or the Clippers, there is a sign of hope. Like, you have a chance to knock this team off, but they fear, you know, the hope that they were like the 2010-11 Heat and they start off 9-8 and try to get their coach fired, all that good stuff, that has not come to fruition. I think, you know, aside from the actually spectacular scoring feats, I think my favorite thing that happened this week was Nick Young's game winner against the Oklahoma City Thunder. If you guys haven't seen it yet, pull it up on YouTube. It's sensational. He basically intercepts a pass intended for Lou Williams and drills a three and says after the game that he should be credited both with a steal and a three-pointer, which is just the most Nick Young quote that has ever been uttered. So we talked about him a couple weeks ago, and just how well he's playing under Luke Walton. I think he's dealing with a toe injury now, so he missed last night's loss against the Warriors. But just good to see Swaggy P fully actualized, because he's been pretty hit or miss throughout his career, but it seems like he's gotten rolling. And the only other thing that is worth mentioning here, you know, I was thinking, like, how many triple-doubles Westbrook and Harden have already compiled this season. So I went on Basketball Reference today to see, you know, their game search goes back to 1983-84, and I wanted to see what was the record for the most triple-doubles in November. Heading into this year, only three players in the last 30-plus years have done it. LeBron in 2007-2008, Jason Kidd that same year, and Rajon Rondo last year. Harden and Westbrook both have four this year. So,
yeah,
there you go. If you're wondering how the MVP race is going, it's still really entertaining, and there are still no shortage of candidates to choose from, what, a fifth of the way through the season? So, no unanimous Stephen Curry this time around. So, let us now move into our My Crush segment, where we're going to shine a spotlight on an under-the-radar player. Sarah, I'm going to start with you. Who's your crush for the week?
You know what else I wanted to mention real briefly? Kind of goes along with the triple-doubles. LeBron right now is averaging more than 9 assists per game.
Oh, yeah.
Which was pointed out on NBA TV last night that would be the most ever for a front-court player. Besting 8.6 by Wilt Chamberlain and himself in previous years. So, of course, it's a long season. And that was my favorite part to watch of Kevin Love going off.
Yeah.
Was him just searching for Kevin and beating him.
It's so mean.
I'm going to take a page out of Morton's book for my crush this time. He did a skill last week.
Oh,
he
did, nice. Okay.
Drummond's free throws.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to do David Lee's defense.
Wow.
Because it has been surprisingly good so far this year. Not just passable. It's been pretty good. Certainly he's made mistakes, but he came into the camp this year in shape. He's energized. He's moving his feet well. He's blocking shots occasionally. But I've just been really impressed with, he's calling stuff out. He's really engaged on that end. He wants to, you can tell that he's aware of the critiques of his game and he wants to be better, and he's really putting a lot of effort into it. So I've been impressed with the way that he's picking up guards coming off the screens. He's showing, he's moving his feet, he's getting back to his guy. So far I've been really pleased with his performance on that end and really everywhere, but defense was the concern. So he's been good.
It's a good crush.
I live to inspire.
All right, Mort, how about you? Who do you have a crush on this week?
Well, I'm actually going to use or mention a guy who I've mentioned before.
Oh.
So this is the second time he wins my crush for the season, and that's Ian Clark.
Nice.
Yeah, I am sorely disappointed that you didn't mention him, Brian, when we discussed the Warriors,
because
he's coming off the bench and he's doing beautifully, shooting almost 46 from free, only 6.4 points a game, but that's fine considering how many scores are on the team. The fact that he's becoming a spot up option is huge for the bench unit. He can take over games at times and really look dynamic. I suspect that he's the type of guy, if he's going to another team at some point, he's going to be like a 12 to 15 point guy off the bench. Like, he has that game. And it's, at the same time, it's dreadfully unfair that the Warriors of all teams has that dude, because they have a copy in him in Pat McCaw, who's going to come along as well. So, but Ian Clark, though, he's just so efficient. He's picking his spots and he's doing whatever he can just to stick in that rotation, and he's doing it well. He's earning 13.4 minutes. I think that should go up. I see no reason as to why Clay or Steph or KD are playing more than 33 minutes right now. They should actually go down a bit, and I wouldn't have any problem making Ian Clark the official sixth man, actually in front of Iggy, and then just making Iggy a sort of a defensive-minded seventh man.
Mm-hmm.
I think that should be the option going forward.
Do you think that even for the playoffs, or is that just kind of keeping an eye on the playoffs to preserve Iggy?
Well, both, because here's the thing. You don't know how Ian Clark would develop in a larger role, mm-hmm. and if he accepts that responsibility, and if he becomes like a fifth scorer on this team, and he can sustain that going into the playoffs, then why change it? Mm. Like, you would need a kick off the bench anyway, and then you can play those two next to each other, because Clark is a 6'3 shooting guard. He's undersized. He's strong as hell, but he's undersized. So you can have Iggy alongside him. It would be fine.
Interesting.
I just like the flexibility that when you have that one guy who turns out to be a lot better than expected, mm-hmm. coming from a championship team, it just offers the additional depth and the fact that you can run some different things. Because if you did not have Ian Clark right now, what would you have off the bench scoring-wise?
Yeah, not much.
Yeah. And he's right now, six and a half points in 13 minutes. That's a hell of a lot of points, actually, mm-hmm. when you think about it.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, so there you go, Warriors fans. As if you didn't already have enough things to be grateful for this Thanksgiving, you also have two young guys coming off of the bench who are going to keep your championship dreams alive for the next 15 years, apparently. I'm going to focus on the Sixers this week for my crush, because I think this guy deserves a little bit more recognition outside of Philadelphia than he's been getting. Ersan Ilyasova, it says something about the Sixers right now with Simmons and Noel hurt that he has been the team's second best player. But let's be honest, he's been the team's second best player. He's averaging 13.2 points per game, which is second on the team behind only Joel Embiid. He is hitting a team high 1.8 threes on over 40% shooting from deep. He's just providing that stretch four presence that is sorely needed next to Embiid. You know, Dario Saric started the first 10 games of the year. He's shown flashes, and he's actually shooting better from three than he is overall. But he's definitely not ready to play full complement of starting power forward minutes yet, which was to be expected, to be honest. I mean, you know, before Ben Simmons got hurt, Simmons was going to play the four to start, and Saric was going to come off the bench anyway. So I've seen some people saying, like, well, the season's already lost. Why are you playing Ilyasova? I don't know how, but Ilyasova doesn't even turn 30 until May. It feels like he's been in the NBA forever, but it's, you know, it's not like they're giving minutes to a 38-year-old. Like, Ilyasova could at least be, you know, I don't think he's a long-term answer for this team, but he could stick around for another year or two after the 2016-17 season. Yeah, he's just providing more than even just three-point shooting. I mean, he's had two double-doubles in the Sixers' past three games, so he's actually rebounding pretty well. And he's just a tough physical player. I think he's setting a really good example for the bigs, for the young bigs, for Okafor. You know, there was a clip that circulated on Twitter the other night of Okafor, I think it was against the Bulls, actually. Okafor tried to set a screen on Taj Gibson and completely whiffed. And then it led to Ersan bricking a mid-range jump shot because, oh, he had a defender right in his face. What a surprise. So I'm hoping that, you know, Okafor, Noel, Rashawn Holmes, Simmons, Saric, all of those guys can learn from, you know, what Ilyasova is bringing to the table. So, you know, there was some backlash when the Sixers traded for him and traded Jeremy Grant to OKC for him. I think that decision's already proving wise, because Jeremy Grant was never going to be a major impact player in this rotation, and Ilyasova has really helped get this offense. You know, it's still pretty bad, to be frank, especially when Embiid doesn't play, but it's at least a little more passable when he's on the court. And I also, just a brief shout out to Nick Stauskas, shooting over 50% from the field and 40% from three this year. So it's good to see him actually being productive. You know, he struggled a lot last year, and he's been hit or miss a little bit at the early part of the year, but he's really, really gotten going as of late. So that Kings trade last year is only looking better for the Sixers and for Sam Hinkie's legacy. So I think that's going to do it for this episode of the NBA podcast. Again, Hope everyone had a great Thanksgiving. Enjoy all the football this weekend. Be sure to check us out on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find, again, all three of our Twitter handles in those bios. Find us on iTunes and download, subscribe, leave reviews, and also check out FanRag Sports at FanRag Sports and at FanRag NBA for a bunch of great NBA content. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek and Morten Jensen and Sarah Chalea. It's always good talking to you guys.
Likewise, Brian.
Yep. Take care, guys.